They say it works when you work it, you know, and that we can only keep what we have by giving it away. Check it out.
My name is Mike, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her own story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in their own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker and believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our promises that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Our speaker tonight, y'all may or may not know this. Some of y'all know him, but he recently shared a stage. In fact, he was the warm up act for a speaker who's an Academy Award winner, won an Oscar. Now, mind you, he was 12 hours before the Academy Award speaker, but nonetheless, he set the stage for the day, and he did a really good job down at the Atlanta Men's Workshop back in October. I've known this guy pretty much since he got sober, I've known him for a good long while, and I'm glad to be able to call him a friend. He frequently sits next to me at the Thursday night men's meeting. He's definitely an addition to that group, and it's really kind of fun to watch him clean up and grow up, and that's what's been going on in this young man's life. And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you all my friend, Rayshon.
My name is Rayshon. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Rayshon.
This is very formal and all of that kind of stuff. Thank you all for allowing me to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And I suppose I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And so it was a cold winter night in Jetni, which it was. It was a cold winter night in January. January 20th, 1986 is when my story starts, because that was the day I was born. And my whole life I always thought that I was born at like 2 a.m., but I was actually born, I'm a prime time baby, I was born around 8 o'clock. So I'm like prime time, which is pretty much like Deion Sanders and all that. Pretty much I was, says everything you need to know about me. So I grew up, my parents, my father, his name was Bobby. He was a bowler. He was a bounty hunter. He was a preacher. And he was also a womanizer. So he was a lot of different things. He was a very interesting guy. And I wish I would have gotten a chance to know him more, if that makes sense. I didn't. My father passed away when I was 17. But he was with me pretty much my whole life up to that point. My mother her name is Brenda, she was not necessarily the loving, gentle, like giving you sweet kisses and all of that type of mom. My mother could be very physically abusive. I did not know that at the time. And I didn't know that that was setting the stage for a lot of dysfunction coming later in my life. Because I didn't know that it was abnormal for your mom to, like, pull out an extension cord, like one of those extension cords that, like, connect one, you know, thing to another. Like, pull an extension cord out of a wall and, like, beat you with it. When you're wearing nothing but your skivvies. I didn't know that was abnormal. I didn't know that other people weren't, like, experiencing that same level of discipline. Because that's what I always thought it to be, is just, I was being disciplined. But it was a bit excessive, to say the least. And my father, on the other spectrum, could be quite verbally abusive. My father would say things like to me, like, you're stupid and retarded and always have to, you know, never be able to amount to anything, and you're going to be a piece of crap your whole life, basically. And I was actually thinking about this earlier today. I was actually not a bad kid. I was kind of quirky and weird, I mean, as I still am today. So, I mean, not much changed in that arena. But I wasn't a bad kid. I didn't really get into, like, excessive amounts of trouble. Like, you know, I wasn't fighting all the time at school or nothing like that, you know. But one thing that I can say is I had a very explosive anger problem. And it usually didn't manifest itself in me hurting other people. It usually manifested itself in me hurting things. Like, I would get upset and, like, pick my desk up and, like, throw it across the room. And then I would come home and my mom would beat me, and that would be the end. And so I had all this anger that was, like, built up in me. And it took me getting sober to find out that that anger was there because I didn't really know how. I didn't know what to. There was a lot of anger in my household. My mother yelled and screamed a lot. She was, you know, just throw temper tantrums, fits of rage. My father wasn't really a yeller, but when he got there, like, it was on. So there's a lot of anger in my household growing up. So I didn't know what to do with that. So what I did with that as a child is that I lashed out at stuff. I would destroy things, and, you know, and I was in special ed classes, is what they called them. Yeah, I don't know if that's a technical name for it today, but they would put me in what's called a timeout room, which is basically like a little small light room. Almost like a jail cell. And I would just get angry and throw my, like, take my shoes off, throw them upside the wall, cry, spit, and scream until I wore myself out and fell asleep. Then I would go home and my mom would beat me, and then that would be the end of it. So I went through school, and I was a relatively good student up until I got to high school. And when I got to high school, something happened. And I don't know what that is. I still don't. But something snapped, and I just shut down. Was not interested in doing my schoolwork, was not interested in doing homework. And I always loved academics. I was pretty good at it. But when I got to high school, something shut down. And I just was not engaged with the rest of the world around me. I was disengaged, disconnected. And that was the one thing I remember when I came into AA that I could relate to more than anything, is that I was disconnected. When I heard people talk about being disconnected, I could relate to that. There was no drinking or anything like that in my household growing up. My father used to drink before I was born, but he stopped drinking like years before I was born, so there was no drinking or anything like that growing up. So, and to be quite honest, I was very opposed to it as a kid, as a teenager. I was not one of those kids that's like, I was really curious about drinking or doing, you know, drugs and stuff like that. Like, I was very opposed to it. I was just like, that's not my thing. My first, if you want to be technical about it, my first drink was when I was 7. I took a sip of my mom's wine. We were at some party. Only time I've ever seen my mother even drink a glass of wine. I don't know if I asked her or something. I was bugging her, and, like, I took a sip off of it and, like, gave it back to her. So, you know. But after I graduated high school, I started working, and I was hanging out with a buddy of mine that I used to work with. And I don't know how we ended up getting this, but my first actual drink that I count was some Old English beer, Old English 800. I don't know if anybody know about Old English, but it's some wonderful stuff. I drank some of that Old English, and we did some other types of, different types of alcohol, the kind that you roll up in some paper and you light it on fire. And before I knew it, I was running down the street at full speed for, like, no reason, like, on my way to the store. And I remember I passed this guy, and he's like, "Man, you look like you running from somebody." And I thought to myself, maybe I am. You know, it's just like, and in a sense, I kind of was. That was my first experience with alcohol. And it was really nice. It was wonderful. But it wasn't the experience. And any alcoholic knows what that means. It's like the experience that you had with alcohol that was just like, this is it. That was not my this is it moment. So I went to the Navy a little bit after that. And once I was in the Navy, you know, I was not particularly a great sailor. And I was not a great student. Because the old stuff that plagued me from when I was in high school, how I shut down, that never woke back up. So I was just going through life thinking that I was just going to, what I thought everybody else was doing, I was just going to go and do stuff in life, do it, be successful, and that was it. But that wasn't the case. Because there was a lot going on internally that I wasn't aware that was really going on. Like, I kind of felt it, but I wasn't conscious of it, if that makes sense. So, in the Navy was probably as far as drinking is concerned, because I understand this AA meeting, and I do respect singleness of purpose, and I'm not going to harp on it much, but drugs was a huge part of my story. As far as alcohol is concerned, being in the Navy was probably my heaviest drinking time. That's what we did. We drank hard, we played hard, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, we work hard, we play hard, that kind of deal. So we would go, we would work during the week and stuff, and, you know, we'd get off work 5 o'clock or whatever. And then on the weekends, if I didn't have duty, there was a friend of mine that I would go to his house on the weekends. His house was like the party house. And it was the type of house that you come up to the door, knock on the door, and somebody opens the door and greets you with a shot, or greets you with a beer. Hello. So it was on from the moment you walk to the door to the time you stumble out of the door. It was on. There were many nights that I was, you know, hugging the porcelain god. I would wake up in a bathtub for no reason. I would wake up underneath some stuff that I didn't even know what it was. I'd wake up underneath somebody that I didn't know who they were. It was like, and it wasn't in the cool way. Like, it wasn't even in the cool way. Like, it was just in a very bizarre, like, I don't even know what happened kind of way. I ended up getting out of the Navy after a couple of years because, you know, I wanted to pursue music. I wanted to be a musician because Jimi Hendrix was, like, my dude. So, like, I was, like, I was set out to be, like, the next Hendrix. I was going to play guitar and, like, be awesome. So I get out of the Navy, and I went to music school, and I went to the Atlanta Institute of Music. And I was going to learn to play guitar very well, and then I was going to be a great musician. But here again, the old problems from high school never left, never woke up. So I was a terrible student. So I remember one night I was on my way home, and there was a friend of mine from my class who was giving me a ride to the train station. And we got in the car, and a bunch of his friends got in the car with us. And I'm like, And they're in the front seat rolling up some of that papered alcohol that you light on fire, put in paper. And it came around to me, and I'm just like, okay, that's cool. And, you know, it keeps going around. It comes back and goes around. So we, you know, pull out of there. We're headed down the highway to the train station, and we're listening to Mars Volta. I don't even like Mars Volta, but that particular night, Mars Volta was amazing. And that was my moment. That was the moment that I knew this is what I wanted to feel like. This is what I wanted to do as often as I could. Because what I felt in that moment was connected. And I never felt connected before. I felt connected for the first time. I was connected to the music. I was connected to my buddy, because then we were talking about, you know, the stars and, you know, the chance. You know, we're, you know, like high people conversation. You know how it is. And I felt connected. Like I fit in. Like I was finally, I had arrived. It's like Bill talks about in his story. You know, I was there. And so every time, every chance I got after that, I tried to engage in whatever I could, no matter what you had, I wanted some, you know. And I was, and it was like it just happened in an instant. It wasn't like it was just like this, no thank you on that, you know. Once it had that moment, something just clicked. And whatever it was, I wanted some, no matter what it was. Lucky for me, like, most of the people I hung out with wasn't, like, into really hardcore stuff. Because if they would have been, I would have been doing hardcore stuff. At a much quicker pace and time than what eventually happened. So, fast forward a little bit, because I don't want to stay drunk forever. Fast forward a little bit. So I had, you know, some issues. You know, I was staying with my mom, and like I took some DVDs from my mother to like pawn them and like buy the smokable type of alcohol that you put in paper and light on fire. I remember leaving my elderly grandfather, who had Alzheimer's, at home to walk down the to walk 45 minutes down the street to smoke a joint, and then walk 45 minutes back. I remember doing a lot of things, but I didn't have a problem. Like, it was cool. Like, it was, it'll be fine. Yeah, it'll be fine. I'm not alright. I'm alright. So, needless to say, after I took the DVDs from my mom found out, because, of course, and I stole, like, a DVD player. Like, that nobody was going to notice that a whole DVD player was missing. Like, so we went to the pawn shop to get his stuff back, and by the grace of God, we were able to get it back. And she was, like, I could tell that she was heartbroken, you know. And the guy who was at the pawn shop, you know, he was recovering. He was in recovery. He was out, and he was giving me a talking to, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I remember standing there, and I'm just, like, listening and looking at him, and, nothing. It ain't even going through one ear. It's just nothing. It's like, you know, the Charlie Brown teacher, just wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah. Like, it was nothing. Even seeing the expression on my mom's face, nothing. So when the doctor's opinion talks about frothy emotional appeal, that is what frothy emotional appeal is. That was my experience with it. It's when my mom was looking heartbroken, when the guy at the pawn shop was trying to get me to see and understand how much I'd hurt my mother and all this stuff. So fast forward the clock a little bit more. So I ended up going to a place called, it was on Pride Street, Gateway. which is basically just a glorified homeless shelter. But I was in this program through the VA, and I started going to, I was living at Gateway, and I started going to, like, substance abuse classes, and it was 2010 at this time. I was 24, and it's when I went to my very first meeting. And the first meeting I ever went to, there was a guy at the facility, at his name was Bone, and I still see Bone from time to time at meetings. He's still sober. And he took me to my first meeting. He was like, "I'm going to a meeting, man. You want to come?" I was like, "Sure." So we went to this place called the Highland Club. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the Highland Club, but it's a really intense place. So we went to the Highland Club, and actually that was the second place we went to. The first place we went to was actually a place called the Leroy Daniels Center. And it was when the Leroy Daniels Center was on Columbia Drive, because it was getting ready to move to where it is today on Covington Highway. But they were still on Columbia at that moment. And I remember being in my meeting, that meeting, and at the end of the meeting, you know, they was like, "If anybody's here for their first time, come and get this white key tag." So I was like, "All right, I'm here for my first time." And Bob was like, "Go get it." You know, I'm like, "Okay." So I get up and go to the front to get this white key tag. And I think I'm just going to walk up there and get a key tag. I get up and start walking in the meeting. And, like, erupts into, like, celebration. Like, people are, like, clapping and cheering. Like, fist pumping. If they would have had confetti, they would have threw that at me. You know, like, they were excited that I was there. And I didn't understand, like, why y'all so excited that I'm here? Like, yay, you messed your life up. Good job. You know, like, this ain't a cool experience. But I found out later why they were excited. It's because there was a life that was being introduced to recovery, to this new way of living. Needless to say, I did not stay sober at that time. Because I was nowhere close to admitting or believing that I was an alcoholic. I didn't even know what alcoholism was. The only idea and picture I had of an alcoholic was a guy growing up in my neighborhood named Freddie. And Freddie was an older black dude, and he would get drunk and, like, get beat up and fall out and pee all over himself. And, like, my father and brother and I would, like, go down and get him and pick him up, throw him in the van, and take him home, because he lived right across the street from us. So that was the picture of the alcoholic that I knew, like somebody that behaved that way. And my experience as I, like, lived in the Navy and all through that never really changed, because the only people in the Navy that I knew were alcoholics were something similar like that. There was one dude we used to hang out with. He would get drunk and, like, fall out in the street, throw up all over the place. There was another guy that we would go to this bowling alley called Parcheesi's, because I was in Norfolk, in Virginia. And this was when I was in Chicago. I was in I was still in Great Lakes, because I was still in A school. We would go to this bowling alley named Parcheesi's, and he would order this big glass of beer, and, like, the first beer that he took, he would shake up to his lips with two hands and, like, shake it down so he could stop shaking. So that was the picture of the alcoholic that I had. I didn't know what else an alcoholic looked like. So when I got back to AA, and you guys were, you know, looking like nice, fancy people like yourselves, you know, people are, like, good looking and, like, you know, look pretty normal. I was just like, "I don't get what you mean by I'm an alcoholic. I don't get it. Y'all don't look like y'all shaking. Ain't none of y'all got pee all over you. Like, I don't know what's happening." So after my first meeting, I spent the next 4.5 years coming in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. And there's some people in this room that saw me during that time of in and out, in and out. One of them is sitting over there. And he would ask me, like, he would see me, and he'd be like, "Hey, man, how you doing?" "Well, you know," he'd be like, "Ooh." Number one, lower the volume. Number two, let me get some popcorn, because I want to hear this incredible story that you have. And it would just go on and on like that. And every time I would come back, it would always be a little bit worse than the last time I left. You know, I'd always be a little bit skinnier. I would always be a little bit weirder. I used to come here a lot to the 9:30 meeting, and I would be dragging like a suitcase and a backpack with me, because they were all my belongings, because I didn't have any other place to store them, because I was homeless. I'm the dude that drinks and get homeless. I like to live outside when I drink. I don't know if anybody else likes to live outside when they drink. It's called an adventure. But I went on a lot of adventures. So as a result of going on adventures, my life kept deteriorating and deteriorating and deteriorating. And eventually I ran into this white powder type of alcohol that you drink up your nose. And then my story came to an end. Because once that enters the picture, it's about wrap up time. Because nobody really, well, I didn't at least. I didn't survive that. Because once it hit, it was like a moon rocket. It took off, and within like months, I was as strung out as somebody that was like on it for years. I eventually came back. June of 2014, I'd been to like 6 different treatments by that time. I had made a lot of sweet promises, as Bill talks about in Bill's story. I had, gone through numerous strange ordeals, ended up in really sordid places, and never got hurt, never got as much as a scratch, That was the grace of God that protected me. Some people, had guns pulled on them and stuff. I never had any of that. It was just like a shield was around me in my insanity. That was God. That's the only thing I can attribute that to. It wasn't because I was quick-witted or cool or fast or anything like that. So I remember I went to this meeting. And I'm in this meeting, and it's a 7-step meeting. And after the meeting, I go outside, and I'm standing on the porch. It's at the Triangle Club. And this guy comes up to me, and he's like, "Hey, man," the same dude that would always ask me, "Hey, how you doing?" He asked me how I was doing that day. I hadn't seen him in a while. And I had to say, "Well, he stopped me in the middle of my ranting and asked me, "Let me ask you something. What experience do you have working the 7-step with the sponsor?" So, I want to say this before I continue on. There's oftentimes, sometimes people in AA can like get into this like, "What you do is none of my business, what I do is none of your business," and won't ever say anything and won't ever challenge anybody. It was because someone challenged me that I stand here before you today. I would probably be dead if he had not challenged me that day. So he asked me what experience I had working the 7-step with a sponsor, and I'd rattle off some type of, mumbo jumbo. He was like, "Well, let me ask you, do you have a sponsor?" "Well, well, that means you don't have a sponsor. Well, that means you got a dumbass for a sponsor, which is you," because I was sponsoring myself, working the steps off the wall and all that kind of stuff. And I grew up going to church. So I was really into religion. So I was the dude that would like sit in a meeting, like fresh off a run, like reading the Bible, telling all of you that you needed Jesus, and like you can't really tell me anything about staying sober and spirituality, which was wrong, real wrong. Actually, I knew nothing about it. The same dude that challenged me that day, I remember, took my big book, and he wrote in the front of it, "Don't think." And he pointed to the very first page, and he was like, "What do you see here?" And I was like, well, the page is blank. There's nothing there. He's like, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what you know about staying sober. Nothing. So I was like, man, these dudes are intense. So we had some more dialogue, and like I eventually was rattling. He was like, wait a minute, let me ask. Are you asking, because it was him and another guy that was sitting there. He was like, are you asking somebody to sponsor you? I was like, yeah, will you guys sponsor me? He was, so the other dude was just like, don't look at me. I don't want none of that. So he kind of sighed, and he was like, all right, I'll sponsor you. And 5.5 years later, he's still my sponsor. So I ended up going to St. Jude's Recovery Center, and I started working the steps. And how I got to St. Jude's is another story that's pretty incredible, but for the sake of time, I won't go into that. But I started working the steps there at St. Jude's with my sponsor, and we would meet up every week, and we would read through the book. Line by line, page by page, word for word. And he would point out in certain spots, and he would ask me, can you relate to anything like this? And for the first time in my life, the wheels started to turn. And I started to understand that alcoholism had nothing to do with what I looked like or what I did when I drank. But alcoholism had something to do with when I took a drink, I couldn't stop drinking when I wanted to. And stone cold sober, my mind would tell me that it was okay to drink again, in spite of all of the horrible, weird things that I had done the last times I drank. Because I'm a dude that, like, he doesn't just drink and have a good time and talk to people. I drink and, like, we'll start throwing up on people. I show up inappropriately naked to places. I might do some strange, I might touch somebody inappropriately. You know, like, I do weird stuff when I drink. So it was probably for the best that I am not drinking. And I started seeing myself more clearly as we were going through the book. So step one, you know, I'll share this quickly because this is an important part of my story. I was at St. Jude's. It was a Saturday morning, and like for the couple of days previous before that, because I get benefits from the Navy every month, like $1,000 and some change. So I had gone to St. Jude's in June of 2014, and what happened on the last day that I used, I'll share this quickly because this is important for me to share this. I skipped over it. My bad. It was one day I got up. I went to my mom's house to go wash some clothes. And I had found a bag of that sticky type of alcohol that you roll in the paper and light on fire. So I carried it around with me all day, and I eventually called my sponsor. And I was like, man, I want to, you know, I found this stuff on the ground. I want to use it. I don't want it. He was like, well, you know, if you want to, use it, because it's not my job to stop you. But let me ask you something. Are you done? And that's not the first time that somebody asked me, am I done? But it is the first time that I ever responded, how do I know if I'm done? And that was my response. He was like, well, you can keep drinking and see what happens. Or you can work the steps and see what happens. So needless to say, I used that stuff that night. I went to the Atlanta Baptist Rescue Mission, and it's down on Peter Street. Got something to eat, took a shower, and I left there, and I was headed back to the Triangle Club, and, you know, got loaded. And I made it to the Triangle Club, and there's this pathway called the Path of Sobriety. And I'm walking up that path, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, somebody's going to smell this on me. Something's going to happen. Somebody's going to do something. So I threw the rest of it away because I still had a good bit left. And I threw it away. And from that moment to this moment, that was the last time I've drank or used any type of mind-mood-altering substances. And that was June 11, 2014. And I woke up the morning of June 12, 2014, which is my sobriety day. And haven't looked back since then. Well, at least I haven't drank. Couple months later, I'm in St. Jude's. It's August, the beginning of August. I have like $2,000 in the bank. My stomach starts bubbling. I don't know if anybody else can relate to that. You got money in the bank and your stomach starts bubbling. You know that bubbly feeling. Don't act like you don't. yeah, I got that bubbly feeling. And I went upstairs, packed my stuff up. I was getting ready to leave St. Jude's, and my roommate comes up, and he gives me his phone number. His name was Jared. I think it was earlier this year, around New Year's, my roommate Jared died as a result of his illness. Because he went back out and never made it back. But he gave me his number, and he was like, man, if you need me, you know, give me a call. I love you. He gave me a hug, and he was left. And as he's going out the door, two other dudes are, like, busting through the door. Almost broke the door down getting in. And, you know, they're toying, pleading with me to stay, and I'm, you know, going back and forth with them. This one guy named Seth, he says something that I'll never forget. He says, if you go back out and you drink, you're going to see everyone's face in here, and it's going to ruin it. And I sat down on the bed, and I was like, in my head, I was like, he's right. Because I had been through that before. Every time I left treatment, all those other times, you know, I would see everybody else's face. See the spaces. Because you make connections with people. Spend enough time around anybody, you'll connect with them in some way. And I decided to stay put. So from that moment on, I gave myself fully to the program, and I started working the steps full on. And my step two experience is really just like put down my guns and allow somebody else to speak into my life. Because up until that point, I had like all the answers. You know, I already knew how to fix my life. And I remember like my sponsor asking me, if you know what you need to do, what am I here for? Like, you don't need me then. And I'm just like, well, you know, maybe I don't know what to do. And step three was just, you know, basically just working the rest of the steps. Because I already knew everything there was to know about God. I didn't really need any more information. Which I really didn't need any more information. What I really needed was experience. And experience is what I got. And I remember as we went through the fourth and fifth step, you know, some stuff started to change. And I started to laugh and like loosen up and like allow the world around me to like be all right with me, and me be all right with it. And but it was around step nine that something happened. And what happened is that restless, irritable, and discontentedness lifted. And I felt free. You know, it talks about, I think in the fifth step, promises, where we can look the world in the eye and be at total ease. Like, I could be around people and be at ease. And I never had that before. I'd never been able to be around people and be at ease. So it's nice that promises start to happen. And, you know, 10, 11, you know, and then I started sponsoring people. And it took a year and a half from the time I did my 12 step. It took a year and a half for me to finally get my first sponsee. It took another 3 years, I do believe, after that, for my first sponsee to make it through a fourth step. And in some ways, I was a little discouraged. Like, I was just like, I don't know, man. Is this still, like, really? Am I just a bad sponsor? Am I just, you know, was my father right? Am I really stupid? You know, like, And I remember what Lois told Bill when he was discouraged in like 6 months, and he's like, nobody's staying sober, and she was just like, dude, you're staying sober. And that's what was happening with me, is I was staying sober. And you know, I could go all night about all the blessings that AA has given me and how it's reshaped my life. I actually live indoors today. I would like to say that I'm gainfully employed, but as of today, that's not actually true anymore. And so there's still a lot of work to be done. But my life is significantly better today than what it ever has been. And even in the face of trouble, even in the face of a loss of a job, I would either be on the verge of drinking or be on the verge of blowing my brains out. One or the other. And I'm in neither of those spaces today. Like, I'm actually relatively at a pretty even peaceful demeanor. So I'll close with this. If you ain't here and you're new, it doesn't matter how bad you think you might be. There's people in here who saw me at my worst. I was pretty bad. And if a crazy dude like me can get sober and like have some relative sense of sanity and decency in their life today, anybody can. Thanks for letting me share.
I just had to remind Rayshon, he neglected to tell you all that he's also in college, which is not bad for a dumb kid, right? And I've looked at some of his textbooks before. It's not mamby-pamby stuff either. Not particularly. So he is still gainfully employed. He's just not making any money at it right now. So he's putting money in the bank, that's for sure. Thank you, Rayshon. That was awesome. This is my buddy, Rayshon. Thank you all for joining the Loot Chip Seekers meeting tonight.
This song goes out to 12-steppers all around the world, as well as to those who have gone before us and to those who may be on their way. They said works when you work it, you know, and that we can only keep what we have by giving it away. Check it out. Okay, this song is gonna help you with your evolution. Only if you're sick and tired of the pollution. The steps that we take are all about solutions. They will even help you make your restitution. The steps can eliminate the negativity and at the same time accentuate the positivity. You may even comprehend the word serenity. Now we're gonna take the steps to our best ability. And the very first step is about a surrender. Hey, you may even be a first-time offender. Or you may be coming back from your last bender. But welcome to the club, you still can be a member. And step two, that's a power that restores sanity. It's greater than yourself, it's not about your vanity. Don't forget about the pain that brought you calamity. Now you owe it to yourself to take responsibility. When we get to step three, it's time to make a decision for our will and lives to undergo a revision. No longer do we have to feel a sense of division. We're on a new journey, so watch out for collision. Steps one, two, and three helps you build a foundation. But don't forget to cancel all reservations. Welcome to your new life, here's your invitation. But more will be revealed, what a revelation. Come on. We take a step to learn to free our minds. We practice principles so we can redesign. We keep it real simple, just a day at a time. We wake up in the morning and we're ready to shine. Hey. It's a natural high, and that's a matter of fact. Come on. We know deep inside there's nothing we lack. Come on. We live in the moment, cause that's where it's at. Come on. It works when you work it, so keep coming back. Hey. Step four is where you're gonna take your inventory. Now we're looking for the truth, not for fame and glory. Just put it down on paper, there's no need to worry. It won't be very long before you tell your story. And step five, take your fourth step and share it with another. Chances are you did some harm to your sister and your brother. The same thing goes for your father and your mother. Now we're living in the light, we're not hiding undercover. Step six is how we deal with our character defects. No longer are we twisted, now we're coming correct. We're building character and we can feel the effect. Now we have a second chance for getting ready to set. In the seventh step, we learn about humility. We recognize our shortcomings and we find stability. But we gotta keep it real and keep it in reality. That's why we take the steps to our best ability. Come on. where we take the steps to learn to free our minds. We practice principles so we can redesign. We keep it real simple, just a day at a time. We wake up in the morning and we're ready to shine. Hey. It's a natural high, and that's a matter of fact. Come on. We know deep inside there's nothing we lack. Come on. We live in the moment, cause that's where it's at. Come on. It works when you work it, so keep coming back. Hey. And step 8, we make a list of the ones we did harm to. We're cleaning up the past, cause it's something we must do. It takes willingness, and we suggest you follow through. What you're about to do is gonna change your point of view. Now in the 9th step, it's time to mend some fences. We step up to the plate about our past offenses. If we're gonna make it right, we drop all defenses. By now we have begun to regain our senses. The 10th step is all about the application, so that we can learn to face any situation. Remember that it's not about a graduation. You know the 10th step is really a continuation. Step 11, we begin to practice meditation. It guides us through the world like a navigation. And we're not afraid to ask for the inspiration, but we gotta keep it moving, there's no hesitation. In step 12, we practice principles on all our affairs. We try to be of help, especially when we share. Now we're living consciously, we are awake and aware. So take this message to another, let them know that you care. Come on. We take the steps to learn to free our minds. Come on. We practice principles so we can redesign. Come on. We keep it real simple, just a day at a time. Come on. We wake up in the morning and we're ready to shine. Hey. It's a natural high, and that's a matter of fact. Come on. We know deep inside there's nothing we lack. Come on. We live in the moment, cause that's where it's at. Come on. It works when you work it, so keep coming back. So there you have it, steps 1 through 12. Remember, you don't have to step alone. We step together one day at a time. And no matter what, we keep coming back. So until the next time, peace in, peace out.